Good morning, ladies and gentlemen, and welcome to the Glucksman Ireland House NYU Radio Hour. My name is Dr. Miriam Nighan, and I will be your host on Saturdays from 9 a.m. to 10 a.m. Eastern Standard Time. You can tune in to us on WNYE 91.5 FM in the Tri-State area, on HD Radio, and worldwide on www.irishradio.com. So whether you're here in New York City, or in Ireland, or somewhere else further afield, sit back, relax, agus fáilte isteach. For those of you who don't already know, Glucksman Ireland House is NYU's Centre for Irish and Irish American Studies, inspired by the vision and philanthropy of Lewis L. Glucksman and Loretta Brennan Glucksman. Glucksman Ireland House NYU has evolved into a vibrant and world-renowned centre for the study of Ireland, Irish America, and the global Irish since its foundation in 1993. We're coming to you this morning from our home, which is an elegant townhouse at Washington Mews and Fifth Avenue in New York City's Greenwich Village. Well, another month that's flying by, folks. We're into the middle of October. We're still keeping busy here with events and teaching and oral histories and lots of other initiatives here at One Washington Mews. We had the pleasure this week of hosting renowned historian Professor Ian McBride. On Thursday night, he spoke to us on a paper entitled The Historian as Healer, Dealing with the Past in Northern Ireland, and I hope in the very near future we'll have an opportunity to listen to some excerpts from that event. It was very interesting and very reflective on how political stability in Northern Ireland can be protected from unresolved conflicts about the past and the role of historians in the process of what we would quote-unquote call dealing with the past. Later today, here at Glucksman Ireland House, for any of you interested in things music, we're delighted to host Professor Mick Maloney's collaboration with TradFest. We had Mick on there a few weeks ago talking about this event. It's called Masters of New York Trad. There'll be a panel discussion with Dylan Foley, Donnie Golden, Joni Madden as part of the second annual TradFest. This event takes place at 1 p.m. today at Glucksman Ireland House. It is a free event. We'd be delighted if you'd like to attend. I believe our faculty member, Jean Butler, renowned dancer and choreographer, many of you would know her of Riverdance fame, will also take place in this event. So hurry down to us later today if you're interested. I'm sure it will be a great event. It usually is. If any of the content of this program has whetted your appetite in terms of further learning about Ireland, Irish America, or the global Irish experience, I'd like to draw your attention to our Master's Program Open House. This will give you information on the Master's of Arts in Irish and Irish American Studies, coordinated out of Glucksman Ireland House here at NYU. That's on next Friday, October 24th, from 5 to 7 p.m. here at 1 Washington Mews. You'll get an opportunity to speak to faculty, to the director of the program, Professor John Waters, and you'll hear about some of the great scholarships we have running and just the general process of applying and what the program is about. It's highly recommended. We will have another one later in the semester and we'll have them on in the spring. But if you are interested in that program, or even if you're just thinking about it and whether it's feasible for you, please do come along on Friday, October 24th. Following our MA Open House next Friday, October 24th, we are hosting another Blarney Star concert. Delighted to welcome County Clare-born Damien Connolly, who is a proficient fiddler and button accordion, which is a rare accomplishment given the high level of technique involved in mastering these instruments. So this event, as usual, Don Mead has put together a fantastic series of concerts for the fall semester. This will take place at 8 p.m. on Friday, next Friday, October 24th, here at Glucksman Ireland House. So if you haven't heard Damien Connolly play live, this is a lovely, intimate opportunity to do so. And it always is a very popular event and concert here at Glucksman Ireland House. Just to have on your radar, folks, because November is nearly on top of us too. On November 6th, we're thrilled to be collaborating with the Irish Arts Centre as part of the Poetry Fest 2014, which runs from November 7th to 9th. And as part of this, we will host our annual Tom Quinlan Lecture in Poetry, which is named for the Philadelphia educator who has a lifelong love of poetry. And it will be the third annual Tom Quinlan Lecture, which will be delivered by the 2014 winner of the Seamus Heaney Prize, that is Tara Bergen, for This is Yarrow. So we're delighted to look forward to that event, and I urge you to pencil that into your diaries if you have not already, on Thursday, November 6th, as I mentioned. It will, if you like, whet your appetite in terms of what the Irish Arts Centre will run as part of Poetry Fest 2014, which starts the following day on the 7th to the 9th. So we're delighted to collaborate with the Quinlan family and celebrate Tom Quinlan, and to also feed into all things poetry as part of Poetry Fest 2014. So this week on our programme, we have two quite different but nonetheless important and interesting interviews for you to have a listen to. When Anne Cadwallader, author of Lethal Allies, British Collusion in Ireland, visited campus 2 weeks ago, I had the opportunity to sit down with her and Alan Brecknell. Both Anne and Alan work at the Pat Finucane Centre in Northern Ireland and talked about the project behind what has culminated in this publication, Lethal Allies, a very disturbing reading on one level, but a very important book on understanding some of what occurred in the North in the period of the 1970s and the really important work that the Pat Finucane Centre is doing in documenting some of these activities and, I really think, giving some peace and solace to some of the families affected by what happened in what was known as the Murder Triangle. So we're going to have a listen to the interview I had the honour of conducting with Anne Cadwallader and Alan Brecknell. Then, to move on to a topic of great interest to anyone interested in Irish-American literature and American literature more generally, I was delighted also to have an opportunity to sit down and talk to author Matt Thomas about his wonderful new book, We Are Not Ourselves, which was recently published and is absolutely, it's already, I believe, at least in a fifth edition right now. And it was wonderful to sit down and have a chat to Matthew about the process of writing this wonderful novel, a novel that's already taken on a life of its own and is doing very, very well. And we're very proud of him as an organisation here at Luxman Ireland House, who has had contact with Matthew in the process of him writing this. So that will be towards the end of the programme, my interview with Matthew Thomas. So I hope that you will enjoy. I'm here at Luxman Ireland House NYU with Anne Cadwallader and Alan Brecknell, both of the Pat Finucane Centre. First of all, I'd like to welcome you to campus. I don't know whether this is your first time at NYU, is it?
It absolutely is.
Okay, yeah. Well, welcome. Yeah. Thanks for taking time out. We're looking forward to an event this evening here on campus. The Breton Law Society very kindly invited us to be vaguely involved in it, and it's a great honour to have people with this kind of profile here in New York University and in Greenwich Village talking about this very important work, and specifically about the book Lethal Allies, British Collusion in Ireland. Anne is the author of that, published by Mercier Press. So I'll start off by just asking one or other of you, I suppose you, Anne, we should start off with, how did this book come about in the first place?
Well, I can't take an awful lot of credit for it other than writing it, because it was the product, or it is the product, of 15 years hard work by other people. People who worked for the Pat Finucane Centre, and more than anyone else, by Alan. Alan's father was killed in 1975. He'll tell you about that himself. As a result of that, he started on a journey researching his own father's murder, which led on to him investigating other people's murders. He'd heard there was speculation that members of the RUC and the UDR were involved in his father's murder. Having established beyond any reasonable doubt that that was the case, he then set off investigating other people's murders, and it spread and spread until we had 120 people murdered by the same gang or permutations of the same gang. Now, 15 years after he started that work, and he'll tell you a bit more about that himself, I became involved, and it took 4 years and a lot of sweat and tears Thanks Be No Blood, with plenty of sweat and tears, and the book was published nearly a year ago now. And we didn't know whether it would be a success or not, but it has been a tremendous commercial success. And more importantly, I suppose, it has, I think, influenced the debate, the agenda in Ireland on what should be done to address the legacy of our conflicted past. But Alan will tell you more about his own involvement.
Before I move on to that, Anne, can I ask you, you were born and raised in London, right? Now, your name is very familiar to me as someone who grew up in Ireland in the 80s and 90s. You know, your name resonates in terms of your role as a journalist. But is there an emotional or personal connection that first drew you into your interest in Northern Ireland and things like
that? Well, to be absolutely honest, when I was a trainee journalist in Yorkshire in England, the biggest story in the world at the time was the Irish hunger strike. And as a trainee journalist, I wanted to cover big stories. So I came to Belfast intending to stay 6 months and to make a bit of a name for myself and then to leave. I came to work for the BBC in 1981. But I discovered that the more I got to learn about the conflict, the more interested I was. And yes, I suppose I did become involved professionally, but also fascinated by the big issues that the conflict in the North threw up. Issues of life and death. When is it justifiable to take life? When human rights are flouted and abused, how far can a people go before they take up arms against the state that is abusing them? When is it justifiable? Issues of nationality, issues of imperialism, issues of my own past, coming from my father was in the British Army, so was my mother, so was my sister, my brother was a police officer, and although I'm not culpable for Britain's role in Ireland over the last 800 years, if I didn't do anything about it knowing what I did, then I would become culpable. So I stayed and I worked as a journalist, and it was an immense privilege for 35 years. I covered the conflict, every aspect of the conflict, the violence, the security, political matters. I worked in Dublin for 7 years as a BBC correspondent, and the peace process. And ultimately, I resigned in order to work for the Papfinucane Centre, and the biggest challenge of my professional life was writing this book.
It's not naive to assume that because you are English, you bring a weight with you in terms of being able to say certain things, right, that a local journalist or somebody developing a book like this may not have the same weight attached to them. You know what I'm trying to
say? That shouldn't be true.
Yeah,
local journalists, Irish journalists, should feel free to say and to write their opinions based on their knowledge and their understanding of conflict. But I reluctantly have to say that I do believe that because I come from the background I come from, it's almost like I have permission to criticise my own country because I'm from that country. I wish it wasn't so, but I think you may be right.
And I think you blur the lines of being an insider-outsider, you know, because you're there so long and you're not of the community, but you are another level. You know, best scholarly research, I think, in sociological and historical realms are done by people who transcend those borders.
Yes, Vincent Brown, when he launched the book at Glasnevin Cemetery last year, did point out that many of the biggest stories, many of the miscarriages of justice and other issues that have been raised in Ireland have been raised by British journalists. That the issues of the Guildford Four, the Birmingham Six, and the Dublin Monaghan bombings were investigated by British journalists working for British television stations. Although, it has to be said that RTE recently has done some extremely good work also on Northern Ireland. But there was, I think, a period in RTE's history where the North became almost a black hole, where people feared to cover the North because there was a feeling that if you did and if you criticised the British state, you were accused of being a fellow traveller of some kind, of being an apologist for violence. And I think that journalists should always speak the truth as they find it and not be influenced by such factors.
Alan, to bring you into the conversation a little bit, would you mind recounting how you got involved in this project or more generally your work at the Papfinucane Centre?
I suppose I got involved with the Papfinucane Centre back in 1989 now. We had long suspected, living in South Armagh, that there was some form of collusion in the attack where my father was killed. My father was killed on the 19th of December 1975 in Donnelly's Bar in Silverbridge. Two other people were killed that night. Michael Donnelly, who was 14, the bar owner's son, and Patsy Donnelly. And about 12 people were seriously injured, including my aunt and my uncle. We got on and lived our life, I suppose, and with the advent of the ceasefires in 1994, people started to ask questions in general about the conflict and what it had been about. But no one was ever charged, no one had ever been convicted in relation to the attack on Donnelly's Bar. In 1999 then, an RUC man who had served time for a murder of a man called William Stathern in 1977 started to make allegations, as they were at that stage, that himself and a number of other police officers were involved with a loyalist gang operating out of Portadown. And one of the attacks that he mentioned in that series was the attack on Donnelly's Bar. So that obviously started us as a family asking questions, and as a strange quirk of fate, the person who interviewed my mother and myself first about that and the statement that was made by John Weir was Anna. So it's sort of come full circle, so it did. And Anna spoke. That was really the first interview that we gave as a family, as to, and it was, how did we feel about what was being said by this ex-RUC man that other members of the RUC, which is obviously, or was the police force during the times of the conflict, were involved in murdering innocent Catholics. So, as I say, we started to look at how was the best way to move this forward. I was told at that stage probably the best people to go to was the Papvanuken Centre. The Papvanuken Centre at that stage was based in Derry, obviously called after Papvanuken, who had been killed during the conflict himself. The Papvanuken Centre was initially the Bloody Sunday campaign, and it was set up by the Bloody Sunday families to get their new inquiry. Once that new inquiry had been achieved, others who were working within the campaign thought it was a worthwhile project to keep going. Martin Finucane, Pat's brother, was actually working in the office, and that's where the name then come from. So they started to work with other families really in the Derry area. I went in and asked how they could help, and they basically said the first thing we needed to do was document what everyone in the area knew about what had happened on that particular night. So we got everyone together one afternoon who was in the bar, took statements from them, and that was an interesting process in itself, because it soon became evident that most of the people who were in the bar that night had never given a statement to the police. Therefore, you start to ask the questions of, well, how was this properly investigated, or was this investigated at all? The next stage along the road, I suppose, was Mommy had always said, and has had Jerry Donnelly, the man who owned the bar, that the investigating officer seemed to be a genuine person. So we put an appeal in the Belfast Telegraph to ask for this man to come forward. We didn't obviously name him, but we said the investigating officer into that event. He immediately, within days, got in touch with the families and said that he was prepared to meet us. He was still a serving RUC officer at the time. He was serving at police headquarters in Belfast. He met with us, and his opening statement to us was, as far as he was concerned as the investigating officer of these murders and other murders in the area, that there was collusion between members of the police, the UDR, which is the locally recruited regiment of the British Army, and loyalist paramilitaries from Portadown. And that was obviously a complete shock to the families. They didn't expect to hear that on that particular day. He went on then to use the term that Anne has used earlier there, that permutations of the same gang were also involved in other murders in the area. And he named a number of incidences, the murder of Sean Farmer and Colin McGartney, who were returning from All-Ireland semi-final in 1975 and were murdered on the roadside not far from Newton Hamilton in South Armagh. He also mentioned the Dublin and Monaghan bombings and the murders of the Reavy and O'Dowd families. So that started the process of where all does this go and how far, you know, what all other incidents are linked in the area. At that stage, I didn't work with the Papvanuken Centre. I was still a sales rep at that time. But within 12 months I left that job, started working voluntarily first and then part-time with the Papvanuken Centre, and in more recent years on a full-time basis. So the research has been going on from about 1999. Lots of people have been involved in it. We've had lots of volunteers across that time and lots of people who got paid exceptionally low wages to do the work that they were actually interested in doing. So it's a culmination of that work. Some of the work was just generally going out and interviewing people in other areas, talking to other families who had been bereaved. It's amazing what families actually do know about what actually happened, what local people know in the area, and pulling all that together. But again, that was still just hearsay to an extent. The Papvanuken Centre then also did a lot of research in the Public Records Office in London, and it's amazing what the British government write down and record across the years as well. But I think we were lucky at one stage in about 2005-2006. Hugh Ord, who was then the Chief Constable of the new police force, the PSNI, set up the Historical Inquiries Team. We decided as an organisation to engage with that at that time, and they produced a series of very, very damning reports about, firstly, the RUC investigations into these murders, but also actually looking at where or who the individuals were who were involved in these attacks. And they are quite categorical in a number of those reports that they give to families. stating that members of the RUC and members of the UDR were involved with loyalist paramilitaries in attacking bars, pubs, houses, community events in the area at that time.
Not to belabor the point, Alan, because I imagine it's incredibly painful to talk about it, but the attack on the pub in which your father was killed, that was simply because Catholics drank there? Was that the logic there?
We can actually think of no other reason for it. As I said, it was the 19th of December. It was the last Friday before Christmas. Up behind the bar, there was a joinery, an aluminium workshop. That's where my father worked. There was about 25 people worked in that small factory. My father was on his way home from the hospital. My sister had just been born 2 days before that. So he had arranged to meet with his workmates, have a celebratory drink, the birth of the first daughter. And as I say, it was also the last Friday before Christmas. So the bar was going to be full.
Mm-hmm.
All the men who worked in that joinery works got their checks changed in the bar on a Friday evening and had a couple of pints. And I suppose, as I say, the last Friday before Christmas. Without some of the people who were actually physically involved in the attack coming forward and saying to us, the reason this bar was attacked is, we can only assume that that's what it was, because it fell into the pattern of other attacks in the area. As you started to look at it, not just in isolation, as to what all was happening close by, it falls into that pattern of places where members of the Catholic community come together to try and live a normal life in a situation that wasn't normal. And we believe, as we've looked through the evidence that we have been able to pull together, that it was basically a terror campaign. It was to try and say to people, you're not going to be allowed to live your ordinary life. We're going to terrorise you. You're going to stay in your homes. You're not going to be allowed to come out. And even at that, they went and attacked people in their homes. There's a number of incidences in the book where a mother and father were both shot and killed in their own homes.
Yeah, one of the husband and wife were killed and the two-year-old child there. It's just shocking, really.
Yeah, Francis and Bernadette Mullen.
Yeah.
They didn't pose any threat to anyone.
Mm-hmm.
And they're sitting at their kitchen table. And their two-year-old son, as you say, is between them. And he gets shot in the legs as well. And it's just horrendous whenever you think that someone can go and do that to someone else.
On that point, on the documentation and the collecting of information and everything, you know, Alan, I'm a historian, and Jodie, the director here at Luxman Ireland House, you know, is really someone who, in terms of historical evidence, going to the evidence, and it's clear in this book, and you make mention, Anne, of similar books that haven't been as thorough in terms of their use of evidence, but it struck me that use of evidence that's so well demonstrated in the book was facilitated by this attention to detail in terms of collecting all this information. Was this just some organic learn-as-you-go training process for you? Because it's remarkable to think of, you talk about different locations, archives that you looked at.
It actually was a learn-as-you-go-along. It was make-it-up-as-you-go-along process. I suppose, well, to an extent it was. As I said, I can remember the very first day that I walked into the Papanukan Centre in Derry and spoke to Paul O'Connor, who was the coordinator there and still is. And his opening words, whenever I told him the story, and he'd never heard of Silver Bridge, never mind the attack on Donnelly's Bar, and why would he have had, like, I mean, it's Derry and Armagh, they're miles and miles apart. But he says, the only way that we can start to look at this is to gather as much documentation as you possibly can. And it was starting at the very basics, going to the newspaper archives and getting the newspaper archives of how it was reported in the days and weeks afterwards. After that, there was obviously inquests held at the time, asking for the Public Records Office for the inquest documentation, because there will be some information in the likes of that information. But actually, the most telling point was actually speaking to people who were in the bar that particular night and writing down their stories. And that was a difficult process for everyone, because people were retelling a story that they'd forgotten for 20 or 25 years. They'd moved on, it was something. And you were bringing it all back to them, and you have to be very cognizant of that whenever you're doing that. But people were willing to go through that because they knew there was a greater end to this.
Mm-hmm.
And the greater end to this is to say, well, look, this is what happened on that particular night. But as you go through the process, you go to another incident. And then you start to hear links, and you start to hear the same names being mentioned. And
that's one thing, Alan, you know, we collect a lot of oral histories here, and, you know, anyone who works with oral testimony, you know, you're constantly challenged by the infallibility of memory and how memory changes over time. But it strikes me, in you describing it, I mean, one of the controls or something that you could use was the repetitiveness with which you'd hear the same name being mentioned or things being described in a similar way, right?
Yeah, and I think that is definitely true. You look at one incident and you hear, oh, Joe Bloggs was involved, and Joe Bloggs' brother, and so on, so on, so on, so. But whenever you start to hear those same names coming up over and over and over again. And I think it's also quite interesting some of the things that went on during the conflict, what communities did to help try and protect themselves. In the mid-1970s, Father Dennis Hall and Father Raymond Murray did an awful lot of work of gathering information in what was known then, or what became later known as the Murder Triangle, after they wrote a pamphlet called The Triangle of Death, where they documented some of these murders in the Tyrone area more especially, but into Portadown and into Armagh as well. And the names that they had at that time are the names that are now being confirmed, or were being confirmed, to the families by the historical inquiry teams. So they knew who was involved at the time. And of two priests doing amateur investigations in the 1970s can finger point who the people were. Questions have to be asked as how a professional police force couldn't have the same names, especially when these two priests were given those names to the RUC at the time. And we've interviewed and spoken to both Father Fall before he died and Father Murray, who is still very, very friendly with the Papanukin Centre. And they have confirmed to us that they spoke to the police at the time, and they spoke to the British Army at the time, and gave them the names of the people that they believed were involved, and nothing was done about it. And I think that's what's more shocking about the whole thing. And that's where lots of questions still remain unanswered. And a number of the families are in the process of taking cases through the Police Ombudsman's Office for that very reason, to try and get those questions answered as to why things weren't pursued that should have, could have been pursued, and therefore, in the long run, could have saved life. And I think that's what's the most damning part of it.
And to bring you back in there, has there been a range in terms of reactions to the book on the island of Ireland, and or I'd be interested to hear the response of like parts of the diaspora, like Irish America, and I don't know whether you've gone to Britain with it. Has there been any divergence in how people have reacted to it?
Well, we'll start off in the north. When we launched the book in Belfast, we didn't know how many people would turn up, maybe 40, maybe 100. Well, nearly 1,000 people turned up. It was overwhelming. The book has sold 15,000 copies. It's one of the best-selling Irish political history books of the last few years. There is a hunger out amongst people in Ireland and the diaspora, indeed, for the truth. They don't want assumptions. They don't want propaganda. They don't want speculation. They want facts, hard facts, sourced facts. And that has been, I think, one of the reasons for the book's success. Now, we've had spectacular lack of success in breaking through the glass barrier in Britain. The publishers hired a PR firm, and the lady who was in charge of our account read the book and was amazed by it and impressed by it, and used all her contacts and wasn't able to get us one single interview from a single radio, TV, magazine, you name it. She tried everywhere, and she was really stunned. She was shocked. And so, frankly, was I. Now, we've had a good response from politicians on both sides of the border. The SDLP and Sinn Féin both have been extremely supportive in all sorts of ways, raising it in the Dáil, raising it in London. The SDLP leader, former SDLP leader Mark Durcan, got an adjournment debate in the House of Commons. Gerry Adams has raised it in the Dáil on several occasions, as indeed have Fianna Fáil ministers and independents. We've had a hearing in front of the Dáil Good Friday Implementation Committee. We've been invited to Brussels by the MEP Martina Anderson, and we got a good hearing there. We have managed to, by dint of sheer determination and belief in our research and in the significance of our research, we have managed to get to places that are difficult to get to. We had a meeting with Eamon Gilmore, the former Taoiseach who's read the book. We were invited to Iris an Uachtaráin Róin at the time of the commemoration of the Dublin and Monaghan 40th anniversary. So we have had areas where we've been successful. This is our second trip to the US. We came over around St. Patrick's Day in March this year, and we're having good audiences. We've been to Boston and Albany so far. We're going to Trenton, Philadelphia, Baltimore and DC. And we have had a good hearing from Irish America. I think there is a tendency sometimes to say, well, we all knew this was going on. Well, we knew that people said it was going on. The difference is that we can now prove it was going on. And I think that is a huge difference. We can prove it because of official documents, official papers, and nobody in nearly a year since the book was published has managed to challenge one single fact in the book or the book's general thesis, which is that collusion took place that it was deliberate, that it was a counterinsurgency policy designed by the British state to terrorise the Catholic community into lowering their political, constitutional and economic aspirations, and that it was part of a colonial policy that the British employed in previous struggles in Kenya, Malaya, Aden and elsewhere, and they imported it to Ireland with a greater imperative of secrecy, of course, because Ireland is so much nearer London than any of those other places. But yes, we've had a good hearing in many places, but we've had a very bad hearing from the British press and from British politicians. And I think that they really, myself of course, I would like them to re-examine their consciences and to re-examine the book and the research and to genuinely begin to consider a more responsible attitude and response to the story that we've told.
Can I push you on that a little bit, Anne? Because, you know, I'm really shocked by that as well. I mean, one would think, right, that the dirty laundry of the Irish question and situation, that there's a level of maturity where, you know, Good Friday is how many years, and I know things aren't perfect, but you would think that there is enough distance for this kind of examination being able to take it. Is it that there are other threats now, there's a worry or concern about other communities in Britain and stuff that is just distracting attention, or?
Well, I think there's several reasons. One is that I think the British think that the Irish question is settled now, and they do have a tendency to urge Irish people to forget the past and move on. And they've always done that through history. The British have always said to the Irish, oh, forget about the past, forget about the potato famine, forget about 1916, move on. It's more convenient for them to do that. Mm-hmm. I don't think they really want to. Obviously, we don't hold David Cameron or Theresa Villiers, the current Secretary of State for Northern Ireland, personally responsible for what happened. But they are corporately responsible. Somebody has to answer. Someone has to tell the families of these 120 people that they acknowledge what happened was wrong and they apologise for what happened. It'll lift a burden of responsibility off the British state as well, if they have the honesty to do that. I think also damage was done to the image of collusion, because there have been other books, as you rightly say, that have been written that have been maybe 70% true, 80% true, maybe 90% true. But if you don't know which is the 90% that's true and which is the 10% that isn't true, then you have to doubt everything. And this book is a first one that's been written that has been, as far as we know, 99.999% true. So far, nobody has challenged a single fact in the book, small, medium or large. So I think there's a natural, I wouldn't want to call it racism in Britain, but there is an attitude towards Ireland that, please will you go away now and leave us alone, we've got bigger issues to concentrate on. But I don't think there are bigger issues than the taking of life by the state and collusion between loyalist paramilitaries and British state servants, and that it was encouraged and sanctioned, and that people died as a result. And I think it would do immense good to the relations between both our countries if Britain would seriously examine what we are saying and come up with some answers.
Yeah, the point you make so well, Anne, in the book as well, is a learning exercise in terms of trying to ensure to the best of anyone's ability that history doesn't repeat itself. I mean, the implications of what's the role of a state in terms of...
But it does go into the future, because counterinsurgency, how you deal... Mm-hmm. with insurgencies within countries is going to be a big issue in the 21st century. If you look at the fallout from the Iraq war and what's happening in Afghanistan and elsewhere in the Middle East, differences between people, insurgency and counterinsurgency, are the big issues, the big military issues of the 21st century. It's sometimes said that the IRA was a ruthless terrorist force and that maybe the British were justified in abusing human rights to combat that. Our view in the Papenhuyken Centre is that it's even more important when you're facing a dangerous foe to behave by domestic and international norms, to obey the law, to uphold human rights, because when those who break the law make the law break the law, there is no law. Mm-hmm. And confidence in the state collapses and it fuels the conflict. Mm-hmm. There's never an answer. The ends never justifies the means, and this is a very, very important lesson for the British to learn as they continue to be involved in global theatres of war in the Middle East and elsewhere.
That's a point well made. Alan, before we finish up, because I don't want to tire you out too much before you talk tonight here with us, I'm intrigued as a historian, what's going to happen to all the records and documentation you've collected?
Well, from our own point of view, it's still a work in progress. I think we need to say one of the things that we promised the families at the very start of this process was that we would tell the story. We said to them that we couldn't guarantee to ever see anyone in court, but what we could do is tell the story, and that's where the book comes from. there was a number of ways that story could have been told. It could have been told in individual incidences. It could have been told as one big report that was published by the Pat Van Ooken Centre, or it could be told in the form that it was told. And after discussions within the organisation and with our board of governors, it was decided that the best way to do it was in this form. And we were lucky at that time to have Anne on our staff, who was published before this, about Holy Cross. So it's important to say that was the main aim, and I suppose to an extent we've achieved that. But out of that has so many other questions have now arisen, that families are still saying, well, okay, we've got so far along the road, but we still need to know the answer to this and this and this and this. So it's an ongoing process. There's ongoing processes with the Police Ombudsman's Office, as I already said. Some families are taking legal actions against the Secretary of State, against the British government in general, and against the Chief Constable. And one of the other big projects that the centre is involved in is a project called the Recovery of Living Memory Archive. And as part of that process, what we have done, it's not complete, it's in the process of working at the minute, is actually we've interviewed families and heard their stories and the impact that the loss of an individual or more than one individual within a family has had on that family. And that's obviously the financial loss, but there's the emotional loss as well. And that has been written up and agreed with the family. This is their version of the loss. We also intend to include in that the findings of the historical inquiries team in each of the individual incidences, and a bit of a commentary from the Pat Van Ooken Centre to say where this particular incident fits within the greater scheme of this series of killings. And they are being lodged in the very near future with the Linen Hall Library in Belfast, with the Cardinal Tomás O'Fee Library in Armagh, and with the National Library in Dublin. They are only a small portion of the information that we actually hold. The families themselves have a right to say that this can be open to anyone and everyone, or it can only be open to the families, or we'll keep it closed for 10 years or 15 years or whatever. That's a small amount of the information. I suppose in the long run, this is something that does have to be properly archived. I mean, as I say, it is 15 years at this stage of intensive research. We also have to be very, very careful. There's lots of sensitive information in this archive as well, and you have to be very careful about how that is stored. And I suppose my own feeling would be the best place to probably store it is the Cardinal Tomás O'Fee Library in Armagh, just because it's at the very epicentre of where most of these attacks and most of these incidences stem from. And Cardinal O'Fee was a great historian. Cardinal O'Fee is from the same parish that I now live in Cullyhanna in South Armagh. I got to know him, I was very, very lucky as an altar boy, I got to know him very well whenever he came to do confirmations and stuff like that in the local chapel. So I think it's something that he would like, you know, as well as I think it being something that practically it's the place for me that it should be kept and it should be stored.
The Pat Van Ooken Centre is a non-profit organisation. So if people listening today, I assume you won't knock back any donations or help, you know, to continue the work you've just described. And I mean, Anne's book as an example of what's coming out of the centre, it's really important and really high standard work that's being produced.
I think that is true. The point about it is that we currently receive no public funding. So we're currently doing fundraisers at home all over the place, and the appeal has gone out so far in the places that we're talking and will do as we go on for any donations that people are willing to make. I think it's important to make the point that within Ireland, the north of Ireland, Ireland in general, there's a huge debate going on about how we deal with the past. It's not maybe as huge as it should be, but at some stage we do have to deal with it. And until that stage comes and there's some sort of a process there, whether it be based on the Haas O'Sullivan document from last year or something similar, this work is still going to have to continue. We currently still get families coming to us, and you think, you know, this is 30, 40 years on, and you're getting grandchildren now coming to say, Mommy, Daddy never talked to me about what happened to my grandfather or my grandmother. I want to know, can you help me? And that's happening on a weekly basis in our office in Derry and in our office in Armagh. So there's a need there. There's an obvious need there if people are still coming to the door and asking for advocacy help and support. And the process is the exact same as I outlined earlier. We will go back to basics in each individual case. And that's time consuming. And okay, we've refined it to an extent now, we've done quite a lot of it, but it's still time-consuming work, and it does have to be paid for in some way. So obviously, if anyone is prepared to make any sort of a donation, no matter how small, it will obviously be greatly received. Our own website, on the front page of it, has a PayPal account, and that's where we're trying to encourage people to come forward. And within that, as far as I'm aware, you can make a monthly donation, small monthly donation, or one big donation, or one small donation, or whatever. And that's basically part of the reason for being here, as well as we think it's very important to explain the book, because it can be quite dense and difficult reading. It's definitely difficult reading. We hopefully have made it not as dense as it maybe could have been. I think it's also important to say that the book could have been 10 times as long as it was. The amount of information is there, but it had to be made in such a way that it was readable, and Anne's done an exceptional job of making it a readable account of some very, very tragic events.
Well, the sales speak for themselves. I mean, that they're phenomenal sales for a book of this nature, Anne, right? And I think it's a great example of what you're doing here at Duxman Ireland House and through the Archives of Irish America. We're really invested in legacy and in terms of people. You know, there's nothing more democratic than sitting down and asking people about their lives. And I know we don't quite touch on the level of trauma typically, although some things do come up that you're talking about in your situation. But generally, in terms of a process of moving on, we feel very strongly that that process of allowing people to tell their story is a really important part of the healing process. Thank you so much for giving so much of your time today, and I hope the event goes very well tonight. And for anyone interested, please Google the Patfinucan Centre and please do support the initiatives that are coming out of it. Thank you, Anne and Alan.
Thank you.
Thank you very much.
I'm delighted to be here with a novelist. We've talked so much about him in the last few weeks, about the event we had coming up. Matthew Thomas, author of We Are Not Ourselves, a novel. Thank you for being here, Matt. Welcome to Duxman Ireland House again.
Thanks so much for having me.
You're not a stranger to us, but we're at this point so thrilled and delighted that the book is out. We've met you a few times here over recent years, I want to say. You've been
That's
here
right.
at Duxman.
Several times, yeah.
Mm-hmm. And it's great to be at this point, for us anyway, and I'm sure for you in the process, that it's being out and so widely and well received and everything like that, Matt. Would you mind telling me a little bit, for those of our readers who haven't maybe heard about the book yet, mm-hmm. give us a little bit of context of what We Are Not Ourselves is about.
Of course. It focuses on a woman named Eileen, born Tumulty. She becomes Eileen Leary. She's born to Irish immigrant parents in Queens, in Woodside, which is an enclave for the Irish, a very heavily Irish enclave at the time. Less so now, but at the time when Eileen is born, possibly 99% Irish in her immediate environs. She's raised in a home that is underpopulated in her mind, I think. She's the only child, and her parents both come from large families. So there's a sense, I think, on her part, early on, of wondering where everybody is. Her father is a very charismatic local figure who's beloved in the neighborhood. He's something of a fixer. He's a guy who gets people jobs, listens to them talk, is a father confessor for them, and is a kind of charismatic center of the social circle at the local bar. And her mother is a cleaning woman. Her father actually primarily drives a truck, but he works as a bartender a few nights a week. So it's a relatively typical home until her mother suffers a terrible miscarriage and is away in the hospital recuperating for a while, and when she comes out, becomes a fairly virulent alcoholic, which really unsettles Eileen in her life. While her mother's away, she conceives, for a couple of reasons, of a different life than the one she has. She begins to dream about a future that would be larger than the confines that she's known for her whole existence. And the story of the book is the story of how she goes about trying to achieve that life of upward mobility and a settledness and a psychic security that she lacks because of the tumult in her own home.
Where did the idea for this come from, Matt? Is it inspired by events in a life close to you or something like that? Or?
Yeah, it's very much rooted in an autobiographical impulse, certainly at the start. I grew up in an Irish-American home and was surrounded by an extraordinary cast of characters, Irish characters, and was fascinated by them from the beginning and the differences between the Irish who had really grown up in Ireland and the ones who had grown up here. I found the culture of the Irish-American environment fascinating on a number of levels. Many different ways that the overlaps functioned and the differences functioned when I was a kid became pressing to me as concerns in the early part of this book. Eileen's father is somebody who is avowedly American, but uses his Irishness professionally in a way that is pragmatic for him as a bartender, whereas her mother, while she retains some ties to Ireland, is somebody who is much more ruthlessly American in some ways, conceiving herself of a different life, an upwardly mobile life as well. So that backdrop was there always for me throughout my writing life, wanting to write about the Irish. And then generally, as I got deeper into the book and it became less specifically about the Irish-American story and more about the story of this particular woman, I wanted the immigration experience and the experience of being the daughter of immigrants outside the pure confines of the Irish to be more of the driving force of the book. So it's sort of a road into a larger American story of movement through class and through time.
Did you do a lot of like background research, Matt, for the book? Was this something that was important to you in terms of migrant flows and things like that?
I did, absolutely. Particularly where people settled in New York. That was important to me to get that right. Because it's not okay to say somebody winds up in X, Y, or Z neighborhood. Because there was a kind of tribalism within the destinations in New York that was felt even, I think, into my early youth. It maybe is less the case now, although there is still some remnants of this. If you go to Woodlawn in the Bronx, there's a real tribal identity there among the Irish that is still felt in Woodside as well, but maybe a little bit more so in parts of the Bronx. I did a lot of research on this side of the divide, let's say the American side, getting to know the history of Queens, getting to know the history of New York immigration. And I did research into the Irish side as well, their land reform laws, what the economic conditions were for these characters at the time, when they would have to leave, and what years the immigration patterns actually happened.
So you've kind of implicitly touched on it, but can you tell us, for our listeners who are interested, what your connection is with Ireland? Are you the son, the grandson?
I'm the grandson of immigrants, yes, yes. So I have an Irish passport that I painstakingly applied for through my grandmother, actually. And so my mother's parents were both from Ireland. My grandfather is from Kinvara. And my grandmother is from Virginia in Cavan. My father's side is also Irish, entirely Irish, except for the Welsh name that I have, which is also an Irish name. It's a controversial question whether it's an Irish name or not. There are quite a few Thomases in Ireland, but, you know, those are basically people who, I think in my family's case, somebody went over to Wales, married a Welshman and brought him back, I think. And so there's this name hitched itself on what is, you know, a largely undiluted Irish population in my family, and yet I'm saddled with this Welsh moniker. I'm kidding. But you know, it's definitely not the first. Irish is not the first thing you think when you look at a word, a name like Thomas.
Mm-hmm. Which is a good and a bad thing, right?
It's funny. Well, it's certainly. I mean, it's interesting to have a name like Matthew Thomas because it's like John Smith. Mm-hmm. You can be anybody in the world.
It's a long book, and there must have been. How long did it take you to write it, Matt?
10 years.
Right.
I was teaching most of that time at Xavier High School, not far from here, and writing the book at night.
So did you always want to be a writer?
Yeah, I mean, when I was a kid, I wanted to be a baseball player, the way so many people do. But yeah, I think when I was in high school, it emerged as something I realized I wanted to do. I had probably wanted to do it before that, but I didn't know what it would be to do that. I wrote little sketches when I was a youngster, but there was nothing that suggested that this was a real way of life. But sometime in high school, it occurred to me that it was something I could actually do with my time.
Mm-hmm. So when you taught at Xavier, mm-hmm. it was English you taught?
It was English and creative writing, yeah. Okay. Mm-hmm. Which was a great deal of fun, with obviously a lot of work and a lot of paper grading. Part of why it took me 10 years was the paper stack was always very tall. And I was always trying to make a dent in it every night. And I would get to work after I graded everything for the day, for the next day, because I couldn't really write with a clear head unless I'd done so. So I would be writing late at night, midnight, 1 in the morning, thereabouts, for a couple hours. And then heavily in the weekends and in the summers.
So when it got to the point, correct me if I'm wrong, in the last year, year and a half or so, that there was this, you know, frenzy or, you know, immense interest from what I can understand in what you had written, on one level it must have been kind of unnerving to have been like, almost like a 10-year pregnancy of something.
Yeah.
And then, can you describe that process a little bit?
Sure. Well, what's interesting to me to reflect on is how probably the most important moment in the arc you're describing for me was finishing the book in the first place, mm-hmm. and feeling good about it enough to give it to an agent to ask him to represent me. It had been so many years and I had worked on it in the shadows without showing it to people. There was always the fear that this wouldn't work out. And I was tough on it. I edited it a lot and I held it back and I kept it to myself, knowing its flaws for a long time. It was only toward the very end that I began to feel good about it enough, as I said, to show it to somebody. So that period was huge for me. It was the watershed moment, feeling that it was ready to show.
Was that a sudden thing, or did that take time?
Hemingway says, how did you go broke? Gradually and then suddenly. I think it was both. It was gradual and then sudden. It was suddenly a moment where I was reading the book and I could read it without seeing all the things to correct.
Mm-hmm.
It's not that I thought there was nothing left to fix, but the process for me had been reading it and hearing the false notes, seeing the words that needed to be struck, seeing the spaces that needed to be filled in. And there came a point when I was reading it and I found I was just reading a book, and that's when I knew it was time to send it out. So obviously that was a huge relief, because I had been in a state of terror at times that this would just not work out. It was a very quick amount of time before I did have an agent. It was a couple of days after I sent it out that he and I were working together.
And that's remarkable, I would imagine, in that industry, right?
It is. is, but I think it's more, it's just a testament to how long I held it. I think many books would benefit from being held a long time. I think it just suggests that a lot of the editing had been done already in some ways, not so much to the quality of the book, but rather to the idea that there is something really worthy in making it as good as you can, because then things can move a little quickly, and they certainly wouldn't move that quickly had I tried to get an agent at some point years before that. I would have met with a no, and if I met with a yes, it would have been a tentative yes, I think. And then after he and I were together, he sold it a month later, so it really just worked out suddenly.
So do you think, Matt, for you, have you thought of another book, and do you think it'll take so long for you to do it?
I am working on another one, and I have only 5 years, so I have a contract
okay.
for it.
So I have
a contractual deadline okay. of 5 years from now. I hope it's not even that long. I think it'll take less time because I'm writing full time. Well, when I'm right. back from this tour, it will be anyway.
And so, Matt, right now, is it premature to ask you, is there a divide or a difference in how Irish-American writers read it and, say, American writ large, you know, American in that broad sense, and then how would the response in Ireland to it? Can you describe
oh,
if there's
sure,
any
yeah,
differences?
Yeah, gosh, that's an interesting question. There's a lot of parts to that.
Yeah.
I think the Irish-Americans will read it and, first and foremost, say, let's see if you got it right, which I tried my hardest to get everything right. So I am relieved and grateful when I hear people say, I recognize that New York, I recognize that Queens, I recognize the depiction of the Irish in this area. And you kind of start there and hope to radiate out from that. You can't get too hubristic about it. I think because I'm an Irish-American, not an Irish person, I tried to box my corner, the small corner, and then make it larger as I could and make larger the space that I was in. So, you know, Irish-Americans in this part of Queens, Irish-Americans in Queens in general, Irish-Americans in New York, Irish-Americans in America as such at large with all of the thematic backdrop of being an Irish-American in America. And then, obviously, Irish-Americans who have ties to Ireland, including Irish people who came over here and were the first generation here. There were a lot of things to try to get right. And that's something of a burden when you're in the process of writing an imaginative work that does also try to extend beyond the confines of the Irish experience.
Also, I would imagine something that might weigh on you is the fact that because you're of the community and you're sensitive of the nuances
sure.
and differences, that it
yeah.
kind of makes it harder in a way an outsider doesn't have that baggage as much, right?
I think so, yeah. And you're also aware of the fact that the Irish-American experience has been written about so often. The word palimpsest comes to mind as something I've used to describe this, something that's inscribed and erased and reinscribed. All you can hope to do is to try to capture it this go-around in your generation. And though I'm describing earlier generations that have been described better by previous generations of writers, to try to speak to that generation within this one as well and fold it into the larger conversation about what's contemporary. So there is an element of self-consciousness, but you just do your best to write around it anyway and just get it done as well as you can.
And then the reactions then of people who are not ethnically Irish
mm-hmm,
or
mm-hmm.
don't self-identify in that way, is that different to how the Irish-Americans read it?
It's interesting because, well, I've been really gratified to hear people say, I recognize my Montenegrin grandfather in Big Mike or my Greek father in Big Mike or something like that, where people can, they can connect to it as a kind of archetypal understanding of the immigrant experience. And I'm tremendously gratified to hear that because I was trying to kind of flip two switches at once, to write an Irish story and to write a more general immigrant story, as I said. So there is a kind of, I would say, more immediately embracing reception of those characters as just immigrants, qua immigrants.
Mm-hmm.
But I've also been very lucky to hear people say, we think you've got it right. And that really mattered to me. So whether the Irish recognize themselves in the portraits or not, I haven't heard as much from them.
Mm-hmm.
But I certainly hope that it resonates as true.
Mm-hmm.
One thing I have heard, though, is people don't always like to hear depictions or read depictions of the alcoholism, because I think it still touches a raw nerve and there's a sense of a kind of airing of dirty laundry that even in this day and age, when there has been so much understanding of the cultural and historical circumstances that gave rise to a lot of the drinking and a kind of forgiveness of the generations in the past and a self-forgiveness in the culture about these difficult periods, there's still a sense in which one is sort of asked to keep it off to the side. And so I've met with a little bit of that.
And did you think about that, Matt, when you were writing about it? Was it something kind of...
I did, yeah. I mean, it's impossible to write about the Irish in America in this era anyway and not worry that any depiction of drinking will resonate as a kind of cliche. But it would be a violence to these characters who kind of pretend that that didn't happen. And so I tried my best to humanize everybody in the middle of it and never to write a portrait that was in any way leering or prurient or anything like that. I meant for all these people's humanity to be understood in the context of their lives.
Mm-hmm. Are you somebody, when you're writing, Matt, did you go back and say, read what had been written, say, I mean, you know, as you've mentioned, the Irish-American experience has been well documented in literature and history. Are you one of these writers who doesn't want to read too much what's been written by other writers, you know, just to give yourself a clear mind? What way does it work for
you? It's a mixture of the two. I read nonfiction depictions of some of the immigrant stories. It's a little harder to read fiction and not worry that it will infiltrate your particular take. And I don't mean to say, you know, that you can write in a kind of tabula rasa state, but, you know, Irish-American depictions of Irish-American immigrant stories in particular, I avoided. The same way that I avoided reading the corrections for a lot of the time that I was writing is because of the way Franzen focuses on Parkinson's, and in this story, Alzheimer's plays such an important role. I wanted to avoid reading that book because of the desire not to overlap unconsciously with some of that material. So the Irish-American writers that I read and loved, Alice MacDiarmid, William Kennedy, Peter Quinn, I'm just reading them as literature. I'm not reading them as Irish-American literature or trying to capture in my mind kind of vicarious sense of the immigrant experience or anything like that. So I'm reading them in the course of things, not really for research.
The final question I'd like to ask you, Matt, is for aspiring writers out there. Your journey through this to date has been that kind of, you know, a journey that many writers have gone through with their first book and everything, you know, holding down a day job and getting on with life in a way and burning the midnight oil, so to speak, in terms of writing a book. And many don't benefit from the reward that you seem to be already getting, which I can imagine and I know by you is humbling for you. What's the advice? I know it's kind of cliche, but I always think it's helpful for people out there who are aspiring to write something. What is your, like?
Oh, this is a great question. It's probably the most important question. Well, can I start by saying that there were years in a row where I was just scared that this was all for me and only for me and would come to naught. There was a period of, I remember, a couple of months where I was really frozen. I couldn't write a word because I had begun to be really preoccupied with outcomes, whether or not I would succeed when I was done. I was looking around at everybody else's works and seeing finished work that were succeeding at a high level. Close friends were into second and third books at this point and beating myself up a lot, I remember. But I had a revelation at one point. It was a bit of grace. It wasn't so much my thought. It was just a thought that came to me. If I sold my book for $1 million and I achieved critical acclaim, why would it be so important to me? Why would it matter? And it occurred to me, with the force of maybe the only unborrowed insight of my life, it would matter to me because it would give me time to write. And once I realized that, something exploded in my head because I thought, every time I sit down to write now, every time I take a couple hours, I'm living as if I've achieved my wildest fantasies. I'm living as if I'm the most successful writer in the world, even though I'm a writer no one's heard of who's writing off on the side and may never actually publish anything. I am, for these couple of hours, this is what I would do if I were at the pinnacle of my career. And once that happened, I settled in. And the work came as if from a faucet after that, because I started remembering that this was just about the pleasure of the work. And actually, my writing improved after that as well. So I would suggest to anybody, the best advice I could give would be to enjoy it as much as possible, because that's what you're going to try to do anyway, even if you're successful. Get back to that mode where the work is giving you life and vitality. And also, don't give up.
I also feel, Matt, just by the way you described that, you're kind of anxious to get back to that again,
yes,
are you?
I am. Yeah, I can't
wait.
Yeah,
wonderful. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Well, listen, Matt, congratulations. We're so delighted that we knew of you and saw a little bit of the process of this coming to fruition, and the very best of luck with the future projects, and hopefully we'll talk to you again soon.
Of course, it's my honor. Thank you.
Thank you. We are coming towards the end of the programme for another week. I'm Dr. Miriam Nyhan, and I want to thank you for listening to the Luxman Ireland House NYU Radio Hour. I'll be back again next Saturday, same time on WNYE 91.5 FM, on HD Radio, and on irishradio.com. In the meantime, if you'd like to get in touch with me or my co-producer, Jamie Sweeney, my email address is ireland.house@nyu.edu. And our phone number here is 212-998-3950. If you'd like to hear this program again, please go to irishradio.com. Stay tuned for the Adrian Flanley Show up next on WVNJ 1160 AM. And for those of you listening on irishradio.com, stay with us here till noon. Have a lovely weekend. Slán agus beannacht.